few weeks ago, I sent off the page proofs of my book on Moses in the Jewish tradition, and it was time to think of another book. And so I contracted with the publishers to present them in a few years a book on storytelling and storytellers among Jews, the history of storytelling among our people. So from time to time, you're going to hear about this or that storyteller or this or that type of story. They reveal a great deal, of course, of the inner meaning and of the basic thrust of Jewish life, so they're not unwelcome here as elements from the pulpit. And the first of these approaches is this morning. I want to talk to you about the fable as it's been used in our Jewish tradition. Dr. Johnson, he of the dictionary fame, described the fable as a narrative in which beings irrational and sometimes inanimate are, for purposes of moral instruction, feigned to act and speak with human interests and passions. In other words, a fable is a story in which animals or objects are personified. And they speak with and act as if they were human beings, and presumably we are to derive some kind of moral instruction from the fable. A fable is not simply a story. It's a story with a point, a story with a bit of moral instruction, a tagged line added on to it. One of the most famous of the fables which appear in the Talmud tells of a fox who was walking along the side of a river, and he noticed the fish darting this way and darting that way, as fish do. And he said to the fish, why are you so busy moving this way and that? What are you fleeing from? And the fish said, we are moving this way and that, fleeing from the nets of men. And the fox said to the fish, well, why don't you come up with me onto dry land? Here you won't have to fear the nets of men. And the fish answered the fox, if we are in danger in our natural element, how much more so will be endangered in an element which is obviously fatal to us? When the Greek, or the legendary Greek writer of legends, Aesop, first put down this fable, the message was, don't be a fish out of water. Stay in your natural environment. In the Talmud, this fable is told by Akiba, one of the great rabbis of the early part of the second century. It's introduced in this way. Just before the Bar Kokhba revolt early in the second century, the Romans prohibited Jews from practicing Judaism or studying Torah. Akiba and his disciples continued to practice Judaism and to study Torah. And a neighbor, a man named Pappas ben Judah, came to Akiba and said, how can you do this? How can you endanger your life in this way? Akiba responded with the fable which I've told you. And he made as the point of the fable, if as Jews we are endangered by practicing Judaism and studying the Torah, it would be fatal for us if we were to cease practicing Judaism and studying Torah. Our traditions, our values would all disappear. And of course, being a rabbi, he couldn't resist adding to the Aesop's fable a biblical tagline in the book of Deuteronomy, Ki hi chayecha v'orech yamecha, for the Torah is your life and the way which gives life. Now, a fable exists then for instructional purposes. It codes human actions in the lives of animals or in the relationship between objects. And it almost always ends with what our tradition calls a mashal, a proverb, some statement which makes very clear what its moral point, in fact, is. Now, these fables, and they're really only several hundred of them in the great classic literature, developed in two main centers, in Greece and in Persia and in India. And they existed, passed on from generation to generation by parents, by grandparents, by friends, uncles, as they teachers, as they told these fables to children. There is a stage, as you know, in our development when we're 3 or 4, when we are convinced that animals talk to us and that animals act just as we do and for the same reasons that we do. But when these stories appear in the literature, they are carefully crafted, and they exist for some kind of more serious purpose. The great French collector and writer of fables, Jean de La Fontaine, said it this way in semi-poetic form. Fables, in sooth, are not what they appear. Our moralists are mice and such small deer that we yawn at sermons, but we gladly turn to moral tales, and so, amused, learn. Now, fables, when they appear then out of the folk literature, are almost always made to give us some deeper, more significant point. The Bible has only 2 fables in it. Clearly, however, the Hebrews and the Israelites had a whole treasury of fables, which they passed on in this underground way, unseen way. But one of these fables is of interest because it illustrates the more sophisticated use of the fable when it appears in literature. It appears in the Deuteronomic histories. It's said that when the men of Shechem wanted to find a successor to the man who was their sheikh, their caliph, the tribal leader who had died, they looked among all of his sons, and they chose one by the name of Abimelech. Now, Abimelech was a crafty and scheming man. And once he had been given authority, kingship, he proceeded to kill all of his brothers, save one, who escaped. He wanted none who could contend with him for the throne. And that one young brother, a man named Jotham, proceeded to climb up Mount Gerizim, which is near Samaria, near Shechem, and to shout out this parable to the people who had elected Abimelech. He told them that once upon a time the trees were looking for a king, and the trees went to the olive tree. And they said to the olive tree, "You be king over us." And the olive tree demurred. He said, "I'm busy producing the fruit which produces the oil which lights men's homes. I have no time to be waving myself above other trees." And so the trees took counsel together, and then they decided to ask the fig tree to be king over them. And the fig tree also demurred. He was too busy producing the fruit that men eat, which they require for their food. He had no time, he said, to be bothered by waving himself hither and yon above the other trees. And so they went to the vine. And the vine also answered in this way, that he had no time to be king over them. He had to produce the fruit, the grapes which produced the wine which men drank. He had no time to be waving himself above all other trees. And so the trees finally went to the lowly thorn bush, and they asked the thorn bush to be king. And the thorn bush agreed. The thorn bush said, "I'll be king over you if you're asking this of me honestly, provide you come under my shade and are protected by me. And if you're not honest and do not come under my shade, I will cause a great fire to go out, and it will consume you even to the cedars of Lebanon." Now, in Jotham's use, the parable clearly contains a rather cynical judgment of kings and of leaders who do nothing but wave themselves hither and yon above people who are busy doing more important things. And there's also coded in the conclusion a prophecy about Abimelech. The thorn bush really does not shade anything. You can't be shaded by the thorn bush. You can't be protected by Abimelech. You've put, O people of Shechem, your trust in someone who cannot protect you. But the thorn bush is also the source of a great deal of the fire, the underbrush fire, which goes out and spreads and destroys the forest. But Abimelech will be a great source of danger to you. Now, the fable of this kind is witty and meaningful, but it has no weapons. And so the Bible tells us that having spoken thus, Jotham fled. In other words, a fable has some power, but its power is very limited. And interestingly, over history, the fables have been used again and again by people in heavily censored societies because they related the dog, the cat, the fox, the wolf to particular governors, tax collectors, tyrants. And since these fables were well known to everyone, the censor couldn't say, you have no right of telling this tale in which the wolf is pilloried as a voracious and cruel and tyrannical animal. Because in fact, the man who would be telling the tale would say, I'm simply telling a tale which is told to you by my grandfather, and your grandfather told it to you. But in point of fact, the man who was telling the tale knew that his audience knew that the wolf was the particular tyrant of their day. And so part of the underground propaganda over time of the oppressed was expressed in many of these fables. Now we know that a number of the great rabbis of the classic period, Hillel, Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabbi Meir, were well known as tellers of tales. We also know that the Jewish tradition, Jewish people, played a very special role in the transmission of these tales from the Orient to Europe. Aesop is the legendary founder of the fabulous tradition in the West. It comes out of Greece. As I said, the other great source of the fables is in Persian India, where you have groups, stories like the Jataka and the Panchatantra, stories about particularly fox fables, which come out of that part of the world. And the Jews, having contact with both of these societies, absorbed both of these traditions, and they were very important in the Jewish tradition, and there were a number of anthologies of tales by the rabbis in Hebrew, and these were brought into Europe and translated in Europe into Latin and the Romance languages. And it is in that way that most of the fables of the ancient world passed into our modern literature, through the intermediation of Jews of the 11th, 12th, and 13th century. And what I'd like to do today is to tell you about one of these men, a man you've probably never heard of before. His name was Barachia ben Natroni Hanakdan. Barachia ben Natroni, the grammarian. Nakdan means the one who puts little dots and lines under the letters which vocalized them. Now, Barachia ben Natroni Hanakdan lived in the late 12th and early 13th century in Norman France. We know that he visited England. We have reason to believe that he lived in Oxford for a number of years, where he was known as Benedict le Puncteur. Now, he was an educated man as well as a learned Talmudist. He translated a number of the scientific texts of the day from Latin into Hebrew, but he's best known and important to us this morning because of a little collection of fables that he brought together under the title of Mishlei Shualim, the Proverbs, the Book of the Fox. There are 100 or so fables in this little book, written in a very precious Hebrew poetic style, with a full of allusions to biblical texts, which is what Judaizes the material. And it's interesting to see, as we look along the text, what it is that he does with the texts of antiquity, because he really works with the material which has been given to him. Remember the story of which we began, the story of the fox and the fish. Well, Barachia tells this story, but he gives it a different slant, a different twist. The fox walks along the river, the fox talks to the fish, the fish say that they're moving about here and there because they're trying to escape from bigger fish. And the fox says, well, come up on dry land here, you won't have to worry about the bigger fish. And the fish then answer the fox by saying, if we come up on dry land, how can you guarantee our safety? Because in truth, there is always someone more powerful, bigger than any animal than you are. It reminds me of that Chag Gadya song which we sing on the Passover. And came the dog that bit the cat that ate the kid. My father bought for Tuzazim, an only kid. There's always in this doggerel some animal, some power greater than the power which is at the moment vaunting itself over some more lowly animal. And of course, being a pious Jew, Barachia says ultimately there's always one higher than he who thinks himself the highest, and God the Most High watches or regards everything. But in the world of which Barachia speaks and to which he relates his fables, In that world, it is a world of the jungle. It's the world in which one must not listen to the blandishments of those who tell us, throw away your arms, throw away your protection, leave your natural environment, put behind you all your cautions, because I will protect you, or because this scheme will provide you with security. The fundamental condition of human life, in Barakiya's fables, or as they're revealed by Barakiya's fables, is that of insecurity. And the mashal, the moral, as Barakiya tells it, is that one ought not to listen to the blandishments of those who promise us peace, justice, the messianic age. Because until God comes and intervenes, until the messianic age really comes, one must always be recognized the fundamental nature of all that is. And he has, of course, a quote from scripture with which to make his point, which for the transgression of a land is it has always too many princes. In Barakiya's world, there is what is called the Gilgul Hazman, the wheel of time, the wheel of fate. Things never are quite what we want them to be. Life never quite works out the way we are. We come up only to go down. The wheel turns. We are healthy, disease. We are, for the moment, prosperous, poverty. We lose what we have. The Gilgul Hazman moves on endlessly, and there is no ultimate security in the world that he knew. And remember that his world was the world of the Middle Ages, the world in which the Jews were tiny little communities in the midst of a vast sea of illiterate anti-Semitic peasants, in the midst of people who were illiterate, who ruled over them, the knights whose code was a code of war and of violence, who made reckless crusades against all others who were not of their faith. Into that world, the fables of Barakiya and Nakhdan instruct the Jew to be cautious, to be careful, and not to let down his guard. Now, there are the kinds of fables that we're used to, the fables which give, you know, positive moral instruction, the kind of material which we would like our children to have. But we ought to remember that from the very beginning, from Aesop on, most of the fables speak of the jungle more than they do of civilization. Perhaps that's why they use the animal as the element. When Herodotus describes Aesop, he describes him as a deformed Phrygian slave, perhaps a pygmy. That is to say, he was not a full-grown man, civilized, whose form belied his character. He was stunted. He was deformed. And what he taught had a certain stunted quality to it. For he taught of the jungle only, of animals, of man and animals, and man is in some way much more than an animal. And so though we find the usual high-minded fables in Barakiya, we find there the famous story of the dog who's in the house, who sees a piece of cheese on the kitchen counter, and he grabs the piece of cheese and runs out of the house to enjoy it. And as he's moving out of the garden, he crosses a little stream by the garden, and he happens to look down off the bridge, and he sees his reflection in the river. You know the story. And he sees the other cheese in the river, and he says, two cheeses are better than one, and he grabs for the second cheese and loses the first in the process. And there's a story in Barakiya of the stag, who has a magnificent set of horns. His horns come naturally. He's really not aware of the beauty and the power of his horns. And one day when he's by the slow flowing stream in the forest, he happens to look down and he sees these magnificent antlers. And he begins to preen himself on the power and the glory which is his. He's the most powerful of beasts. He's the most beautiful of beasts. There is none like unto him. And hunters pass by and they loose their dogs against the stag, and the stag plunges into the forest, and his antlers catch in the underbrush, in the bush of the forest. Pride cometh before the fall. You have those kinds of fables in Barakiya, but you also have another kind of fable. You have the fable about the ape. The ape who had two sons. One son was particularly beloved to him, and one son he frankly couldn't stand. And the family had a lot of troubles. But one day a leopard began to circle the ape and his two sons and began to go closer and closer. He was obviously about to pounce. In order to protect himself and his beloved son, the father ape devised a scheme. He took the son he didn't like, and he threw him on his back. And he said, when we run, I'll be able to toss him off my shoulders as to the leopard. The leopard will stop, and he'll eat the son I don't like, and I and my beloved son, whom I will protect between my knees, we will be able to escape. And so he threw the son he didn't like on his back, and he took the son whom he loved, and he took him on his thighs in front of him to protect him, and he began to run. And the leopard began to chase and was about to pounce. And when he came to try to take off of his back to throw as to the leopard, the son he did not like, the son, who was no dummy, grabbed on as best he could to the hair of his father. He grabbed this way, and he wouldn't let go, and the father couldn't reach back and force him loose. And he had no alternative, if anyone was to escape, but to take the son whom he loved from between his knees and toss that son to the ape in order for it, at least himself and another, to escape. The escape is made. The beloved son is lost. And Barachia in the fable says that years pass, and the older man learned to love the son whom he couldn't stand because he was with him and a companion to him and took care of him in his old age. And that's the whole fable. It's not the kind of fable that you would want to tell a three-year-old, lest you give him nightmares. But it does suggest the cold, cruel world. It does suggest that fathers and mothers ought not to have a favorite, because in time you can never be sure how your favorite will turn out, and that the one you don't like or one you can't stand, whose vibrations are not yours, will not suddenly be the one who cares for you in your old age. It says something about parental love, that in fact part of that love involves in the fact that these are our immortality, that these are our security for future times. There's a certain cruelty to it. There's a certain cynicism to it, a certain callousness to it, but there's a certain realism, particularly when you remember the world of which Barachia was a part. It's a world which delighted to tell the story of the fox, who was walking out one day, and he chanced across a very succulent garden. And he went around the garden, because it was fenced in, looking for a way to get into the garden. The fence was simply too high for him to be able to bound over. And he found in one of the slats of the fence a hole. And he tried to slither through, but he couldn't make it. He was too fat. And so he fasted for 3 days and for 3 nights. And then he was able to slither through into the garden. And when he got into the garden, he feasted for 3 days and for 3 nights. And then he began to hear the owner of the garden and his dog approaching, and he wanted to get out of the garden. And he came to the hole in the fence, but he was again too fat. And he had no alternative but to hide himself in a corner of the garden and fast again for 3 days and 3 nights before he could escape into freedom. Now, the fable is first told in the name of Aesop. And when Aesop tells the tale, the moral is that time takes care of everything. When Barachia tells the tale, the garden is a symbol of life. The fox slithering through the narrow hole into the garden is birth. The fox leaving the garden is death. We come in with danger. We leave without anything. Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. It becomes a vivid illustration of a biblical text. And it says something about not caring too much about the things of this world. They are attractive, they are succulent, they are good, but we can't take them with us. And ultimately, in old age, we have to give up all of the fatness of our youth. So in Barachia, you come across a world which is full of uncertainty, a world in which cooperation is necessary for survival, but almost impossible to maintain. He tells a fable about four oxen. These four oxen watched their parents and their grandparents, and they saw how one by one they were picked off by the lions and the leopards. And so the oxen made a covenant of fellowship. They would always be together. They would always watch the four corners. They would see what danger came. And if they were vigil, they kept their vigil, no one could successfully attack them. And day after day, week after week, they kept this compact. And a lion saw this quartet of oxen, and they were fat and they were sleek, and he began to want to enjoy them. And he began to follow after the quartet. But they were careful. He was not able to attack until finally, one day, he decided he had a system, and he began to call out at night to one of the four oxen, a special one, and began to tell him slander about the other three, that they really were conspiring against him. If any attack would come, they had determined he was the one who would be the scapegoat, the sacrificial ox. And ultimately said that the lion said to this ox, your only chance is really to escape. Leave them alone, and I'll be able to go after the three of them, and you'll be the one who will go scot-free. And the ox was induced and seduced, and he walked away from the other three, and the lion pounced, and the lion ate, and the bellowing of the three who were left behind could not save the ox who walked away. Fellowship is the only way of survival, but fellowship requires trust, and trust does not come easily to the human beast. There was a line in the sayings of the fathers which we read today that, was it not for the fear of government, the weak would be swallowed by the strong. That was the kind of world in which Barakiah lived, that only force enforced security. Security was rare then and unstable. It was a time when one had to be careful always of oneself, take care of oneself, and protect oneself. A wolf came down to the river. He was thirsty. And he saw, some way down the bank of the river, a sheep lapping at the water. And the wolf turned to the sheep and he said, sheep, what are you doing drinking my water? And the sheep said, kind sir, I acknowledge your power. I have no intention of doing damage to your water. I'm not muddying it up at all. There's plenty of water for all of us. And the wolf said, but it's my water, and besides, once upon a time, your ancestors wronged me. And the sheep said, kind sir, I'm only a year old. I have not wronged you, and I'm doing no damage to your water. Fresh water is coming down the stream all the time. I'll leave if I'm in your way. And the wolf pounced, and he killed the lamb, and he ate the lamb. Cruel story. A story which suggests, of course, that flattery, the diplomatic skills, the kindness, turning the other cheek, does not, in fact, always tame the wild beast. That the kind word does not destroy the arrogance of the arrogant. In fact, it may make them more arrogant. It was a world in which the Jew knew very well that he was blamed for the acts of his ancestors, though he was not involved in them, the charge of deicide, which was so much a part of the medieval world. It was a world in which the Jew had to fawn on the local prince, even though he was illiterate, because he was the prince, he had the arms. And the Jew knew that for all of his fawning, ultimately his life remained insecure. He was in danger of exile or death. And so these fables are filled with this sense that were it not for the fear of government, for some kind of force, the weak would always be swallowed by the strong, that being weak is no virtue, that turning the other cheek is no way to gain salvation, that one must be cautious and prudential, concerned always and at all times. And that, incidentally, is generally the picture that comes to us when we look through collections of fables, and if we're not reading them in some kind of bottlerized form. Fables come out of a time when, for most people, life was a jungle, when those who lived in the jungle with them were the predatory beasts. The sheep is so often the victim, and the sheep is almost always the person are the people to whom the story is being told. And the predators, the wolf, the sheep, the lion, the leopard, these are the powers that are above, the powers which cannot be controlled, the powers which can suddenly pounce and maim and kill and destroy. Now it's interesting. In our time, such fables have been transformed into Walt Disney. And the world of Aesop has somehow become the world of Rudyard Kipling's Just So stories, which is to say that in modern times, the fables have become less violent, less cruel, less realistic, and they become children's stories, something they never were in the beginning. It says something about the fact that in modern society there is some due process, there's some trust in government, in justice, there are some controls over the powerful. It says something about our romantic spirit, that even though it is true, as we can all testify from our own experience, that weakness and poverty are not always protected, that we are filled with hope that this in fact may be. And perhaps one of the reasons that as adult literature the fables have tended to disappear from off the shelves is to be attributed to the fact that we really don't want to think of the world as a jungle. We'd like to think of it as civilized. We'd like to think that the human being is something more than a human animal. And of course, in fact, we are, or at least all of us have the possibility to be. And I would simply leave you with this, that if you find in the years ahead that the fable has come back into its own, has again become a popular means of literary expression, you can be sure that the sense of insecurity which we now limit to the center city has permeated out into the suburbs where people buy and read the books of fables. And it bespeaks a society which has lost the optimism, the confidence in civilization of the last several centuries. A society which psychologically and emotionally feels itself again in a crueler and colder world. In that sense, of course, I would hope that the fable never appears among us as a popular literary form. But so many of the fables are useful as educational and sermonic devices. They're part of the armory of any rabbi, of any teacher, of any parent. They're wonderful to read, to think about. And it's interesting to, when we do, to remember that Judaism was taught best by its stories and its fables. Theology was for theologians. The stories and the fables were for everyone. And it is through the stories and the fables that we can understand the heart of a people. And it's because of that that the history of stories and storytellers is, I think, worth the writing. Amen.